RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Let the joyous news be spread. The wicked old witch at last is dead.
Ding dong, the witch is dead, the wicked witch, the witch is dead, the house landed on her. In this case, the house has landed on the disinformation project. They've announced they're closing down, and I thought we would probably want to talk about this at some point at RCR, which is right now. So the demise of the disinformation project, our panel to talk about this morning, Alia Bland. Morning, Alia.
Morning, Paul. Hi, everyone.
William McGimsey. Hi, William.
G'day, Paul. Hi, everyone.
And Catherine Ennis-Carter. Love saying
Hi,
your name.
Hi, Paul.
Catherine Ennis-Carter. Thanks for coming on, guys. Do you think it was fair enough to play Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead? Do you think that was fair enough? Anyone? Does it about sum it up?
Well, I, for one, am very happy to attend the funeral for the demise of the Disinformation Project. Unfortunately, I don't think the ideas and the people involved are quite worth a funeral just yet. They're probably still around and probably still will go on to do further so-called research.
But maybe they're like zombies.
The whole thing was based on a lie, wasn't it? Like they made out that they were going after disinformation. They made out they were going after falsehood. And if that's what they were doing, maybe there would be some merit to it, because there are bad things that can happen when the population believes false things. But that's not what they were doing. They were going after political opinions that the government didn't like. And the way they were doing it was Orwellian, and it was sinister. They were attempting to stigmatize and demonize people who had these opinions, perfectly normal opinions, like criticizing the vaccine, which you're allowed to do, perfectly normal opinions like being critical of immigration, perfectly normal opinions like not wanting your kids trans in school and stuff like this, opinions that were perfectly normal, within like 5 minutes ago. And what they attempted to do was to conflate people who had these perfectly normal opinions with violent extremists, with terrorists, basically saying you're no different than Brenton Tarrant, if that's what you think. And we need to have the whole power of the state peeking in on what you're doing, keeping tabs on you, and cracking down on you like a ton of bricks because you're a threat to society. So that is just completely wrong.
Didn't they call you a Nazi, William?
Yep. Sanjana Hatatua wrote a blog post about Dewa De Boer and I calling us both a neo-Nazis. But this was actually much more recently than when the Disinformation Project was doing most of its stuff. This was a sort of recent thing within recent months. That's false. I mean, Dewa and I talked about this. Like, I'm not a Nazi. I don't want to kill all the Jews. I don't want to have a totalitarian society. No, I don't want to start a big world war to take over the world so white people can rule over everyone. I don't want any of those things. So calling me a Nazi is just a way of making people think bad things about me and to make people think that my political ideas are wrong. And not even by arguing, making a logical argument for why I'm incorrect. It's about conflating it with like negative emotions, like with negative stigma, so people are sort of turned off and turned away from it. That's really what they were trying to do.
There's an easy way to do that, wasn't it? Because, they can just scream Nazi in anybody's direction and that automatically shuts down the conversation. I mean, we had that thrown at us many a time, including on the Fire and Fury documentary, which was heavily associated with the Disinformation Project. And, you know, they overlaid pictures of or video footage of Nazi women marching, doing salutes and things like that when they were speaking about us. Caring about children's health and being interested in craft and things like it is kind of, it was crazy, you know. And while it's laughable now, at the time it was full noise. And all of these like organisations, government departments, the media, institutions seem to be working together to, you know, amplify this sort of message out there. There was a point in time and stuff where it felt like any article that you opened on their website had a link to the Fire and Fury, or had the Fire and Fury video embedded on the page to try and sort of get as many people watching it as possible. And that had huge effect on people like us, our organization, and our ability to do things.
Should we talk about a bit of history here? Catherine, an operation like this, normally in the public service, how would it operate? Would a separate department be set up, and it would have its own kind of management structure and offices and stuff like that, and get allocated a budget? Because it didn't operate that way, did it?
No. Well, normally, I mean, that would be what would occur if you were trying to take a public management approach to it. But obviously, the purpose of this was to remain semi-covert, because they didn't want to be transparent. They didn't want to be seen as being directly associated or funded by government, which they were, of course. They wanted to be able to masquerade as academics and researchers who were doing all this valid research to point out to New Zealanders the dangers of disinformation. But if we just go back into the history of this, this project emerged. I'm not going to say set up. It emerged in January, February 2020, but it was obviously set up much earlier than that, because by early February, they were already established under the Te Pūnaha Matatini umbrella at Auckland University. And clearly that had been in process for a while, because you don't have a formalised approved abstract ready to start with the terms of reference. Usually those things take months to get through, but they were ready to start in January and February. Officially they say February, but I heard Kate Hannah on a radio, a New Zealand interview that same year, and she specifically talked about January. So, and the truth about that emerged from the cabinet paper that came to light under an OIA request. I think it was dated October 2020, which conveyed how deliberately the government was using NGOs and the media and academia to promote the narrative that it wanted to promote and market about COVID-19. And of course, then, you know, the disinformation project, I think, was at its heyday around the time of the Parliament protest. And of course, they made capital on that with the Fire and Fury and Web of Chaos and Undercurrent, all those things. But to have an abstract set up that early on was not only advanced planning, because the government wanted to get in front of any opposition to the COVID mantra. And but it's also, I think people need to understand very clearly what that was about. So I want to talk about that for a moment. It was clear from the abstract at the very beginning that they were working with a definition that is of mis and disinformation that is a completely bogus concept, because it operates off the basic assumption that there is a body of truth and everything else is mis and disinformation. And of course, this was the whole angle that we heard from the Labor government with the podium of truth. But the reason this is so important that people understand this is that its purpose of using this a bogus concept is to actually encourage a groupthink compliance with the official narrative or whatever, and to demonize. This is achieved by redefining and demonizing any questioning of that narrative or any opposing opinions, as William said, as mis and disinformation. And so the definitions are suspect. And as such, what it's actually doing, it's a tool for manipulating public opinion. And I think this is the first time we've seen such a deliberate government sponsorship of the manipulation of public opinion. And the way they did it, they've used it as a tool for demonising the opposition and therefore maximising the propaganda. And so it's really inextricably linked. I hope it will go in history as linked very deliberately to a very shameful period in New Zealand's history when we had a Prime Minister who wanted to create two classes of people based on willingness to be dosed with an experimental gene therapy. And the significant fact of that was also a period where the government actually mandated a scapegoat group that the public were encouraged to hate. And so when anybody who spoke out against, in the beginning, the COVID narrative, and now, of course, it's broadening out to other issues, when demonisation of that group and cancelling of that group was also mandated and officially, unofficially, covertly sponsored by government. So I think, you know, it's very important that we recognise the shameful history of that, and we can laugh about, you know, when you look at Kate Hannah espousing the dangers of white supremacy and, you know, the ridiculous statements that were made about that, about how we all had to look at our own white supremacist colonial history and we, you know, we should be ashamed about that and take a step back and look at websites, you know, of women who braided their children's hair or knitted Scandinavian patterns in their clothing. You know, these people were actually dangerous domestic terrorists because they were promoting a white supremacist diatribe.
Those lines, those lines are going to go down like the Ropata line out of Shortland Street. People will be referring to braiding hair and knitting together in that way for years to come. It's going to just go into the lexicon, you know.
Well, I hope that it gets remembered by people with utter embarrassment for such a shameful mechanism that was used against the public in New Zealand.
Were they just the disinformation project, the people there, folks, were they just the useful idiots really in the end, you know, for the bigger uses, higher uses?
Well, of course they were from my perspective, but it's also clear, it's actually interesting to look at their website now because they make some very lofty claims about what they've been doing. So, you know, and it's all in the language of, you know, all this wonderful research that they were doing and the legacy of all their reports that they've prepared. And the lofty claims there, it says, we helped pioneer best practice analysis of the Aotearoa disinformation landscape and its impact since the issue first emerged.
What a salad.
But these people are zealots. You know, they actually see themselves as pioneers against what they call a global backlash against progressive measures.
They've invented some terms too, haven't they? And I wonder what our panellists think because they've in some ways been caught up in all of this to various degrees. Dr. Sanjana Hatatua specialises in advising on information disorders as if it was some kind of medical thing. Have any of you got a misinformation disorder that you need help with?
Well, he's got a showering disorder. We were to take the web of chaos.
But those salady terms and those sort of new ways of putting things that sound slightly academic, technical, you know, sophisticated, I guess, for the messaging to the great unwashed. Alia, you were caught up in all of this. What did they say about you guys? Can you remember some of the lines?
Well, I mean, you know, the clip that we were just talking about, you know, to step back a little bit, if you saw any footage out there or anybody that was interested in children's health or braiding their children's hair or yoga, or, you know, they had this whole montage of dangerous activities, which were all very sort of pedestrian everyday stuff. That was all totally targeted at us. So Claire, Libby and I, who started up Voices for Freedom, you know, my background more recently was in crochet design. pattern design. Libby's a pattern, a knitwear pattern designer. Claire was involved in a blog that was all about healthy children's food for lunchboxes and things. So they were specifically going after us and the things that we were doing prior to setting up Voices for Freedom, so that they could then tar anybody else who happened to like those things with the same brush, as if we were some kind of dangerous domestic terrorists. And that was the reality. I mean, we laugh about this stuff now, but I'd put money on the fact that our phones were bugged over that time. We could hear it on the line when there were things that it appeared that people were listening, right? Like, you could hear the difference in the line, and it clearly stopped at a point. And I am pretty sure that the Disinformation Project was working hand in hand with other agencies, like, well, obviously the DPMC, but also the NZSIS and media and a whole cohort of people, which is why I've recently just put in a Privacy Act request to all of those departments to see what I can find out what they have on me and with relation to the Disinformation Project as well. We can talk about that a bit later. But, you know, the reality is of being targeted by these people in this way, where they had their little reports and their reports were reported in the newspaper as if they were sort of gospel and fact. And the roll-on effect of that was, you know, that we became public enemy number one at that time. And in our communities where we lived and, you know, our families felt very unsafe. And, you know, to the point where I actually had a high-ranking sort of member of the community who had a high position come over to our house one morning and offer his support to my husband and I, because he could see things were racking up on the community page and had the potential to go violent. And, you know, this was the sort of the end result of the kinds of things that the Disinformation Project was whipping up in the community with respect to how people viewed us and the danger that they thought that we were to the society.
William, do you think they'd know that they were whipping up that sort of feeling, like Alia was just, I mean, that's over the top, Alia. I mean, gosh, you know, that's getting to ridiculous and scary levels.
Yeah.
They'd know that, William, wouldn't they, in advance, that they could unleash that?
It's an interesting debate. Like, they talk a lot about social cohesion, right, and about the idea that, you know, people expressing their political views and too much contradiction between the mainstream view and maybe outsider views, that is something that undermines social cohesion. But I wonder whether that's right. So free speech scholars have this idea of a safety valve theory, right? And safety valve theory, the idea is that having the ability to express your view, express your opinion, allows people to blow off steam and prevents things escalating to violence. So this is the opposite way round to what the Disinformation Project were arguing. They were arguing that people expressing these views, these, you know, these misinformation views, was really racking up distrust and racking up, you know, undermining our social cohesion. But the free speech argument is that actually, when people are able to talk to each other, when they're able to engage in political debate, they're able to debate these things through the normal democratic processes, you know, around the water cooler, but also in the media, also using their vote, also having political protests, that's actually a way of heading off violence. So I think that the SIS, the security people, were involved in this too. I think that they had their way of thinking about it backwards. What they did didn't protect our social cohesion. What they did undermined our social cohesion. They made things more divided.
Hmm.
Yeah, they had their Know the Signs campaign, and that was talking about, for, you know, encouraging members of the public to keep a watchful eye on their friends and neighbours to see whether or not they were developing an us versus them worldview with respect to the COVID response and government sort of political things that were happening in the country at the time, you know, fairly everyday things that people might have issues with. So then they were turning, you know, good Kiwis into potential terrorists with this ridiculous campaign that came out, which appeared to be, you know, hand in hand with what the Disinformation Project people were doing as well.
Which is kind of a form of doxing, really, isn't it, in the end?
Mm. But I think, going back to your point about they're doing, I think there's three things there. One is, you know, it's particularly unfortunate that a lot of the stuff coming out of academia is kind of going down a particular track. But the insidious nature of giving it the stamp of the academic label is that it also introduces another weapon, which is associated with all this, is that they're trying to give everything that they want promoted as part of the narrative, the stamp of authority. So this is given as, you know, how people can judge whether something is mis or disinformation or wrong information or whatever, is that they're constantly reminding people to check against, you know, whether the information has come from authorised sources or an authorised publisher or whatever. And this is a typical characteristic of this whole disinformation ideology. I think, you know, when academia is promoting this kind of stuff, and there's a terrific amount of international work using this whole bogus concept of mis and disinformation now, we have to realise that, you know, when it comes to academics, one of the principal pressures for academics is to publish. And so, you know, they're academic opportunists. They're always looking for, you know, a particular new or fancy angle that they can put into their writings that will draw attention to them, and they get profile from that, and they therefore, you know, get jobs and funding for their research. So, you know, but not everything that's coming out of academia is very good at the moment.
Yeah, right. I understand.
And just to illustrate that, I want to get, you talked about some of the language and the terms that they use, like information disorders. There's other ones that I picked up that particularly interested me this morning. Inauthentic behaviours. You know, what are these people talking about? And crisis communications. You know, we're not just talking about word salad, but these terms get picked up and they become part of our lexicon.
Well, they get laundered, don't they? They get laundered. And I was going to get onto the media, yes, because that's the root, isn't it? So you've got academic pronounces something, and then it's taken into, you know, what looks like a credible reporting because it's a, these people are qualified and it's a reputable news source. So that launders the information to a level of respectability for then to be consumed. I mean, it's so obvious.
That's exactly right, and it's very deliberate. But you have to laugh at some of this. And one of the expressions that I picked up from the Disinformation Project website today was that Mr. Hototawa is going on to continue his work in truth decay.
Truth decay. Not tooth decay.
The trend of truth decay.
Well, not enough fluoride in
I'm
the truth.
Very happy. Well, I think that RCR should continue being the dentist too.
Keep drilling, right? Keep drilling.
Tell us all about the analysis of
root
truth
canal extraction if it's needed. Yeah.
One of my favourite ones was malinformation. You remember malinformation?
Yeah.
Malinformation was true, but you had some sort of your negative intentions or bad intentions. You were spreading the truth with ill intent, so it was malinformation.
I wonder how many more of these words there'll be. Miss, mal, this. I mean, there must be room for a few more.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, the definitions, like the concept itself, are completely bogus.
So it seemed like a couple of things happened around the same time. Okay, we have the demise of the Disinformation Project, but we had Chantelle Baker and her, you know, settlement with NZME, and I think that involved disinformation, and she's going after them still from the last time I heard. And also just very recently, the release by the NZSIS of old, pre-World War II, 30s, Germans in New Zealand, and a Russian spy in the early 60s. They've released those documents. I had a perusal of them a day or two ago, and they're very, they went everywhere after the Russian, all over the place. Everything's reported. It's all, you know, typed, though, back in the day. And I'm just wondering if those three things have come together just coincidentally, or there's some timing going on here. Anyone got any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's very interesting. Timing is everything, as you say. And it's interesting that one of the unfortunate legacies of this disinformation project is the extent to which their terms, and their work has been translated into that of other government departments. And this whole concept of mis and disinformation is coming through. But probably more insidiously is the extent to which this idea of a group of domestic terrorists as conspiracy theorists emerging out of the anti-COVID-19 measures. But now the Disinformation Project has accused many of our community as morphing into a whole lot of other areas. And so the recent report from the New Zealand Security Intelligence Service continued to condemn people with opinions which are contrary to the progressive orthodoxy as not only conspiracy theorists, but as dangerous domestic terrorists.
No mention of the gangs.
So I think, you know, the timing of these things coming out, the timing of that NZSIS report was I think, an indicator.
Yeah, and also Kitteridge was talking like this too a year or two ago before her term ended. Like, I think that was where the inauthentic behaviour line came from, maybe from her. Yeah, they're all talking, singing off the same song sheet.
The other aspect of their legacy, I mean, I hope they will be consigned to history with the embarrassment that they deserve, but at the same time, their legacy also includes a significant amount of harm that they've done to individuals, as Alia has been talking about, and also the fact that, you know, this stuff is morphing into other government reports.
Alia, what would satisfy you, and we can't speak for the others, but, you know, if they saw the light and saw the damage they'd done and thought, well, we better start apologising and we'll give Alia Bland a call and tell her how sorry we are that we got it so wrong. I mean, would that be acceptable?
Won't be holding my breath.
No, I know. But you know what I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
What would it take?
Some kind of apology and some kind of accountability would be ideal, but I certainly don't see that happening. I mean, right now, I think, you know, the demise of the Disinformation Project, people keep saying, you know, what was it, the final thing that tipped them over the edge? But I think it's a whole lot of things. I think, obviously, the change of government and their attitude towards that particular organisation hasn't helped them, especially probably concerning money and funding. But then there's also the things like there's been several court cases that Kate Hannah has been tangled up in for the comments that she has made that have been defamatory. And so those are playing out through the courts at the moment. And then, I mean, this is probably very minor in the scheme of things, but 17 months ago, I put in just randomly decided to make a Privacy Act request after the Posey Parker incident to the Disinformation Project, asking for all of the information that they had on me. And initially, I was engaging directly with Kate Hannah on this, which I found quite amusing, given, you know, the things that she said about us, and we were both being quite polite, and I kept my cool. And she sort of delayed and delayed and delayed getting me this information. There was all sorts of excuses as to why I hadn't had it yet. You know, it was months in the process. It was only meant to be a 20 working days kind of a turnaround as per the law. And then all of a sudden she decided to just ghost me and stop responding at all. And I hadn't got any of the information. She was saying it was quite a big job because in order to give me everything that they had on me required a lot of redacting of other people's names. And we knew that. We knew that that was part of our plan. We were going to do that, make them tie up all their resources, redacting names, and then hit them with another request from either Claire or Libby and make them do the same thing, you know, by redacting my name and unredacting the others. So it was sort of a way to just, you know, keep them busy and not doing other things. Anyway, I eventually thought, okay, well, this is a bit ridiculous. And so I took it to the Privacy Commissioner, and they investigated for a few months and, well, made inquiries with them as to why they weren't doing what they were meant to be doing. And then we opened a formal investigation into that. And that you know, this is 17 months later now that of a 20-day request. and they are finally, I just got a message back from the Privacy Commissioner's office on Tuesday that was saying that they have exhausted their sort of avenues of options to try and get the information out of these people. And they have said things like, yes, they did intend to respond, but the person who was doing the work was on leave, but they didn't have a return to work date. They were just permanently on leave there. You know, wow. So it's all very ridiculous, but they were trying to tell the Privacy Commissioner that they were going to go ahead with it, but they never stumped up with the goods. And so now they have said, look, we can't really do any more. They're failing to engage with us and not doing what they said they would. And they've referred me on to the Human Rights Review Tribunal, which actually, when I've looked into that, seems like a better thing to be doing because they can actually award compensation and things like that. So that's where I'm going with that at the moment, but I'm still trying to get the information that they have on me. And not just because, I want to know that, but it's sort of more of a, it's more for the whole of the community, right? What they had on me was what they were looking at for everybody. You know, to try and discredit us and make us look bad in the media. So, yeah, I think it's due to a whole lot of factors.
William, what do you think the final blow was for them? Is there any one thing, do you think?
Well, I think the idea of disinformation in general, what they've done is they've sort of cast the net too wide. The range of opinions that they're considering mis or disinformation, the range of views they're trying to characterize as extreme and violent, it has just gotten too big to the point where it's almost the whole right-hand half of the political spectrum at this point. And obviously you can't at a certain point you're trying to tell too large a proportion of the population that they're violent extremists and it's not going to fly. But there's been this long-running process of political correctness in Western societies, maybe since the counterculture movement of the 1960s, where certain opinions progressively have been demonized, using the various politically correct terms, you know, racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, and they keep inventing new terms as they invent new identity movements and we go along. And so progressively more and more opinions have been put in the, you know, you can't say them box as we've gone along and gone through this process. And what's also happened during this time is that the concentrations of progressive people in our institutions, in academia, in the media, in the public service, the concentrations of progressive people as opposed to conservative people have been growing and growing over this period as well, which has encouraged more and more groupthink and more division between elite opinion and the opinion of ordinary people in society. And I think that division has just sort of grown to the point where it's not really tenable for them to be claiming anymore that, you know, they're right and everyone else is disinformation. It's just really a disagreement between elite opinion and the people that are being ruled over. And so that it gives you the appearance to ordinary people like they're being ruled by an occupation government that doesn't really represent their views and interests. And so this is a real big problem in Western societies that needs to be resolved at this point.
Were they jettisoned by the coalition government? Does anyone know? I don't think New Zealand First would have been fans.
No, well, maybe their funding has stopped. That's why they're probably closed down.
Yeah. So what was the high point? The documentaries that you remember all of them, Catherine? I'm impressed. Fire and Fury and what were the other
Undercurrent.
Two? Undercurrent. Yes, that was the RNZ one, wasn't it?
Yeah. Web of Chaos.
Web of Chaos. Was that the high point of their work, do you think, folks?
I think so. If you look on their website, they've churned out a number of reports going over the same kind of territory. But I just want to make another point that, as you know, I've worked internationally as a governance and public management consultant. So as soon as this disinformation project emerged, you know, it's very close to the bone for me in terms of what I've you know, experienced personally in looking at and being in an ex-Soviet situation and unraveling the ravages of all that. And I think, you know, I really want to make strongly the point that, you know, this disinformation project and the people who are associated with it I think they should be ashamed for being such shameless facilitators of a period in our time when when ordinary people had to fight against government sponsorship of the deliberate manipulation of public opinion. And unfortunately, it's still with us, and we have to keep fighting against that. But I, for one, having experienced personally what totalitarianism is, the methods used, and seeing that starting to emerge in our lovely country, I just feel terribly sad about that.
Hmm. Shameful period in our history, basically. If we look back to the Disinformation Project, that will always remind us kind of where we were and could end up, because there's still a risk, right? There's still a risk.
There's still a risk.
But it seemed to be, you know, this whole time you had these people who were put up on a pedestal, the former prime minister, and then people like the Kate Hannah, and you know, they were the darlings of the media. They were being gone to for comment on all sorts of things during the time, and I just couldn't help but think at that time, you know, they're up the top right now, but it's going to turn, and they're going to come tumbling down, and here we are, the feet are out the bottom of the house.
Yeah. And ding, dong, ding. And everyone's sort of kind of happy, though there are still some believers out there. And let's not fool ourselves. I see quite a few comments, not that I go looking too much, but, you know, the people who think that former prime minister was still, you know, like an angel on earth, and people are still banging on, you know, well, so you're an expert then. And, you know, when did you last do an epidemiology degree? You know, people are still saying that, not in dribs and drabs, but, you know, in numbers still.
In quite some numbers, unfortunately.
There's a trend. There's a trend in across many countries, including New Zealand, many Western countries, about people losing trust in their institutions. And it's been going for quite a while, but it's accelerated in recent years. And it's easy to see why. I mean, it seems as if the idea of expertise and the experts, they sort of wheel out the experts when they want to, in the government or whoever wants to convince you to do the thing they want you to do. And so that it's sort of had a corrupting effect on that trust in experts over time, because people were thinking now, well, I mean, are you really telling us what you think is right, or are you just telling us what you've been told to tell us because you're part of the opinion management system? And so I think the trust in experts is declining. It's going to continue to decline as long as people continue doing things that way.
Should there be an inquiry into the Disinformation Project? There's a question. Let's unpick it right back to seeing everything, the guts of it.
I'd love to see that.
The guts of it.
I'd so love to see that, yep.
Yeah. I'd so love to see that too.
But surely you can make a convincing case to call for one, actually.
Yeah.
I think the entire way the government's communication strategy around the time of COVID, everything they did was attempting to manipulate public opinion rather than providing people information and allowing them to make their own decisions. They were using information to manipulate people and in government policies and other ways as well. There's a real problem with, this is called the nudge approach, right? The nudge approach, yeah. We're trying to manipulate public opinion to achieve better policy outcomes. But when we're moving into a time of AI and increasing, you know, technology, the ability to control the public and the way they behave, there's a real question as to the appropriateness of sort of nudge policies, because, you know, eventually if technology is going to become so good that there'll be, you know, even if you have formal freedom legally to do what you want, if you've got AI and all this other machinery, the ability of individuals to do something different from what the people in charge want them to do will just continually reduce over time with all this new technology. So we have to be very careful about that, to guard practical freedom rather than just legal freedom.
Well, isn't it a coincidence then that according to Kate Hannah's bio, former member of the Disinformation Project, that she is a representative on the Global Partnership on Artificial Intelligence Responsible AI Working Group. So aren't we lucky?
Well, she also had I don't know whether she's continuing it, but she had a position with the American State Department to be involved in some work. I think it was generally within the category of mis and disinformation.
Oh, there you go.
But, yeah, I mean, those connections are quite obvious.
Yeah, these people are all, they're all networked globally, so that's a, it's a real problem.
That's why you wonder where it stops. Where's the organisation or the taproot? What's the taproot?
Well, the taproot's often difficult to track down, but I think one thing that struck me a few weeks ago when I was listening to Elizabeth Rata, and she was talking about the unholy alliance between three main schools of academic thought, which have morphed into social norms. And she was talking about postmodernism, critical social justice and critical race theory, and retribalism. And I think, you know, the when you look at some of the people involved in the disinformation project and the perspectives and intellectual frameworks that they were coming from, it's easy to see how something like this particular project and its associated research is a manifestation of exactly that. So, you know, in terms of, yes, we can, you know, we can make the connections, but you're really fighting against, you know, something which, as William was just saying, is a global trend. But we have to keep pointing out to people that ultimately these are tools for manipulation of the public mind.
We're coming up against time, but Alia, I remember now, you went to was it a seminar of some sort featuring the Disinformation Project? I think for health, public servants and health.
It was Countering Disinformation and Public Health. And
that's
actually,
right.
Catherine was there too, but we didn't know each other at the time. Well, we knew each other on email, but we didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know what she looked like. We were plants in the audience. It was a day course from Otago University. Very interesting, because Kate was there in all her glory and basking in the adoration of the 70-odd people in the room, who she could do no wrong, and that was, you know, quite sickening to behold.
Right. Do you think that was appealing to her ego at the time? Could you see that
playing
out?
Oh, was it ever? Was it ever?
Undoubtedly. Yeah. You know, there was a whole attitude of fawning sycophants in the room. It was awful to behold.
Well, you'd feel on top of the world if you were her in that situation.
Of course.
Oh, she did. It was her and Paula Penfold, actually. Both of them had the same kind of air about them, and they could have said anything in that room and everyone would have bowed down. You know, I had to consider at one point I wanted to actually out myself in the room, but I was diagonally on the other side of the room from the door and I wasn't sure that I'd actually make it out of the room.
Like, okay.
That kind of...
Think it through, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, what an experience, eh? But... different now, under the house with the shoes sticking out.
Yeah, the red shoes.
Hero to, well, not quite zero. They'll all probably get jobs. Anything more to say, because we're coming up against time, about the demise of the Disinformation Project? William?
Well, I think the most important thing to do is just make a real effort to be more courageous and say what's true. And even if people are going to, you know, demonize you, stigmatize you, do whatever to you as a result. I think if the critical mass of people can do that, then these sort of tactics will stop working anymore. And courage is contagious. So the more people who do that, the more other people who will see it and do the same thing. And that is my my plan for ending this sort of behavior from the government and other people.
Right.
Having a bit of courage and speaking the truth.
Courage. Catherine?
Yes, I'm absolutely with William on that. I think we just have to keep standing up for the right of ordinary people to hold opinions that diverge from whatever they're being told as the current orthodoxy or the progressive truth or the government's official mantras. People have a fundamental right to their own opinions, and, you know, we have to keep reinforcing that.
And Alia, last word.
I agree with what the others have said. I just think stick to your guns, keep speaking the truth, and the truth will out eventually. I mean, it always comes around to being the obvious thing, and we're seeing that right now.
They always seem to forget that bit, though, don't they?
Mm.
That, you know, it will come out and we will have to deal with that at some point. And it usually happens.
And hooray for that.
Yes. Yeah.
All right, I want to thank Alia Bland, William McGimsey, and Catherine Ennis-Carter for coming on this panel discussing the demise of the Disinformation Project. Thank you, folks. Do you think we should go out on that, that tune as well? Oh, come on, let's do it.
I think so. Go on.
Why not?
As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead. Then this is a day of independence for all the Munchkins and their descendants. If, yes, let the joyous news be spread, the wicked old witch at last is dead.
Ding dong, the witch is dead, witch of witch.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.